I am coming into your house with my hand outstretched. I am your friend. Do not be afraid of me. Columbia Workshop presentation of The City Wears a Slouch Hat, a radio play, his first, by the distinguished American writer Kenneth Patchen. The orchestra of sound players was under the direction of John Cage, who composed the special score. In the cast were Madeline Grayson, Jonathan Hull, John Larkin, Frank Dane, Forrest Lewis, and Les Tremaine, who played the voice. Les Mitchell directed. The Columbia Workshop today originated at WBBM Chicago. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
KBAL Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Antes que te conocí.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2018-19 concert season. Tish Hinojosa is the featured performer at the February 15th concert. Singer-songwriter Tish Hinojosa's songs are a blend of Americana, country, Latino, and pop. She has been a featured artist at the White House, Austin City Limits, and Prairie Home Companion. Again, Tish Hinojosa appearing on the PFS stage on Friday, February 15th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church, located at 2901 Southeast Steel Street in Portland, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Serengeti at the Alleyway on Friday, February 15th from 7:30 to 11 p.m. at the Alleyway Bar in Portland. Underground hip-hop artist Serengeti, also known as Kenny Dennis, returns to Portland for one night only. Local artist Champion Loves You, Mosley Wata, and DJ Cars and Trains will also perform. Again, that's Serengeti at the Alleyway on Friday, February 15th from 7:30 to 11 p.m. at the Alleyway Bar, 2415 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm. on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to Talking Earth. This is Patrick Bocard. You're listening to KBO Portland 90.7. I have the good fortune to have Rima Zaman. She is an award-winning author, speaker, and actress. She was born in Bangladesh, raised in Hawaii and Thailand, and presently lives in Oregon. She is the Oregon Literary Arts Writer of Color Fellow 2018. Is that their only one, or is there...
I was the only Writer of Color Fellow.
Okay. And her work has been found in the New York Times, Dear Sugar's podcast, The Guardian, Narratively, Shape, Vita Review, among others. She proudly partners with various organizations like Girls Incorporated in Literary Arts to empower diverse voices and mentor the next generation of leaders. Thank you for coming on the show, Rima.
Thank you for having me.
So your new book, I Am Yours, is a memoir. It is a story of your your story of your upbringing, mm-hmm. actually, in
Bangladesh and Thailand. Yes, it begins in infancy. And it goes all the way to age 31, and I'm 35 right now. And I Am Yours will be published for worldwide release February 5th, 2019. So just a month away.
You are listening to Talking Earth. Or a month. Or
a little less, yeah.
Or a week ago if you're just now listening to this.
That's true.
Yes, time travel. But yes. I Am Yours also refers to the other major character in the book.
Yes.
Who is
the imaginary best friend from childhood whom I never released. So I met this imaginary best friend, or I invented this imaginary best friend, this presence, when I was about 3. And she would tell me, she would arrive anytime I needed comfort or company because of a confusing time in my life. And she would tell me 3 things in particular. She would say, I am here, I love you, I am yours. And throughout my life and throughout the course of the book, the relationship between myself and this best friend, it evolves and it morphs, and so does my relationship with the reader. And sometimes, and so I've written it in a way, so of course the entire book, it's I break the fourth wall and I'm speaking directly to the reader / imaginary best friend, and it becomes this deeper discussion about faith, about inner voice that we all have, about the conversations we hold in our own being, particularly when we are struggling, and how by reaching deep within, we all have the resources to be our own voice of calm and strength and resilience, and most of all, of love, particularly when we need it most, particularly when life feels lonely and scary.
Which does come up several times in this book.
Right. It is. My life has experienced, I've experienced some difficult traumas and cycles of traumas that I've had to break and heal from. And I'm Yours was written as a manual of healing, not only for myself, but for anyone else who needs it. I began writing, I always kept a journal ever since I was 10 years old, and I would scribble little ramblings and poems for myself, as many people do have that story. And I never did conceive, though, that I would sit down and write and then publish a book. And in my mid-20s, I was in an abusive marriage, and it was during that marriage that I started waking up with these fully formed essays, or chapters, if you will, that were perched on the doorstep of my brain. Every morning I would receive another essay, another chapter, and these essays, they were sent by my inner voice, trying to comfort me, trying to give me the love and strength I so desperately needed while I was trying to navigate that abusive marriage. And I would write down, I would type up these essays, and by reading them back, I started to gain the clarity and the strength and self-esteem that I needed to speak back to him. And so when I was able to get out of that relationship, I took inventory of these chapters that I had written of this mysterious book, and I realized, you know, if they had held so much value for me, perhaps if I fleshed this into a larger book, a memoir perhaps, maybe it could be of service to others. Maybe it could help someone else break free from the cycle of trauma or abuse in their life. Maybe it could be a delivery and offering of the love that they needed to voice their truth and claim their power in this world. And that was, I had that, you know, that revelation back in the beginning of 2013 while I was still living in New York. And I was working as an actress and a model. And once I had that idea, everything in my life fell into stark clarity. And I realized I had to take an indefinite leave of absence from the acting industry because it wasn't fulfilling me at all. And I had to figure out how to write this book and get it to publication. And I got a one-way ticket from New York to Oregon. I came here on June 1st, 2013, with this audacious goal. And we are watching it come to life now.
You did have some family here, though.
I did, yes. So my mom and my stepdad live here. I call my stepdad my dad. And so so during that abusive marriage that I was in, I started, you know, looking back into my own history, into my childhood, and I realized there were a few things that had happened in my childhood and teenage years that I needed to go through a reckoning, and I needed to go through some healing. And it was because of those unhealed traumas that I had been all the more susceptible to falling prey to a toxic relationship. And I had this hypothesis that if I moved in with my mother, and while she was, and if I moved in with my mother in a loving home, and if I watched her laugh and be in love with a man, that would actually give me a lot of healing that I needed, and a lot of healthy lessons about what authentic love looks like and feels like. And I thought, wouldn't it be miraculous to feel that osmosis of learning and wisdoming and love, and at the same time write about that journey? And so I made a proposition to my mom and dad, and I asked them, I told them I had this dream, this goal of writing this book, and I was going to give myself a calendar year to write the first draft. And I asked them if I could move in with them for that duration. And they probably thought I was having an emotional breakdown because I had, after all, just left a toxic marriage. But because they're my parents, they said, yes, of course, come home and do what it is you need to do. And so my sister, she had just left for U of O, Oregon University, as a freshman, and I slipped into her high school bedroom because I wanted to see what it would be like to live in that home as that girl, because I had grown up in a different home. And day after day, I would wake up and I would write for about 8 hours, and I would have dinner with my mom and my dad, and I would just watch them, and I fell in love with their love and the way they support each other, and I learned so much. And through all of that, I healed so much, and I gained what I needed to write this book, because it's a book about, you know, taking stock of the things that so many of us go through, whether it's being witness to unkindness or being agents of unkindness. I had gone through a series of sexual assaults from the time I was, and sexual predators from the time I was a young girl. So I was, being in a safe home with my mom and my dad allowed me to go back in time and investigate those wounds, as well as the lasting ramifications of those wounds, and then heal those wounds, so that I started writing from a scar and not the wound, and I started living from scar tissue as opposed to the raw, hot pain of a wound. And I wrote the book. I signed with my dream agent, and I started doing speaking engagements around Oregon as well as nationally, and I started publishing essays. And so that has been the last couple of years, and everything has just been this, my mom calls it a seamless explosion of things aligning. I think we human beings, we are, our legacy in life is created by the combination of the child we once were, as well as the adult we are today. And every time that we stand inside of our purpose, for instance, I know that my purpose in life is to be a voice for the stories and souls that have been historically silenced. And whenever I stand inside my purpose, I know that I am being of service to the child I once were, to the child I once was, as well as the children all around me. And everything feels just very right.
A lot of this book, especially the ending, is about like helping children.
It is.
And also, one thing I have thought of when you were talking about going back and living with your mom and your dad, and now your papa, who is also part of this story too.
He's a huge part of my life, yes.
Is having another part of the story is your occasional friends in New York who you babysit for.
Yes, yeah.
And one of whom was a, I'm assuming, famous tennis star that no one will ever know who he is.
Well, I'm happy to say. He's a really dear friend of mine.
We don't need to bring that out into the open.
Okay.
Yeah. But one of the things about it is that he actually, one of the important scenes in the book is that he models what being a good husband is and a good father at one point.
Yes.
And you realize that your ex-husband is not, then husband is not doing that.
Yeah, I've had the enormous gift and blessing of having been part of a lot of adopted families. And to explain on that, when I was an actress in New York, I would supplement my income by being a babysitter and a part-time nanny. And those families I worked for, they became my adopted brothers and sisters, and I had all of these nieces and nephews. And I started working with children long before that, long before my 20s. It was my high school in Thailand. We had these programs where you could, there were community service programs, and I always used to sign up for every single one of those opportunities. And I started working at orphanages throughout Thailand from the time I was like 17, 18, and then throughout college, during the summers, I would go back and return. And I do write about all of that, and because I do believe children are our greatest teachers. We're all born as children, and we're born innocent, and we're born with trust in our hearts toward human beings and life. And then it's through the things that adults and life does toward us that our faith begins to crumble, and we become either the love or the pain that is modeled to us. But when we arrive on this planet, the love is unblemished, that faith is unblemished. And that's why I've always aligned my life with kids. You know, and yes, when I moved to Oregon here and to write I Am Yours, the first couple of months I just focused on writing, and I was able to, because I was living with my parents, they basically gave me a residency and I didn't have to pay for food or rent, and which is amazing. It's such a huge gift. And then I started working at a kindercare, different kindercares around town, around Beaverton, as well as an elementary school down in Beaverton. And I write about how it was so remarkable to have one foot in my childhood and one foot in the lives of other children, and watching them, you know, every day bearing witness to how they were learning to navigate the world. It has always taught me so much. And one of my greatest thrills and joys is, I mean, actually just this morning, right now it's January 14th, 2019, when we're recording this, just a few hours before arriving in the studio, I received news that the North Clackamas School District has received an innovation grant from the Oregon Department of Education to adopt I Am Yours into their high school curriculum for juniors and seniors. Because I Am Yours will be used as a teaching tool to help students engage in critical discussions around race, sexism, opportunity gap, privilege, social justice, healing from trauma, the Me Too movement, and our path forward, and to help students engage and claim the power of their voices so that they can be leaders and conduits of courage, empathy, love, and kindness in this world. And I'm just so proud, because like I said, this book, I wrote it with this very intentional purpose of it being a teaching tool not only for myself, but a manual of healing and strength and comfort for others. And it's so amazing to see that happening now. It's very fulfilling.
One of the other things I think it's actually very useful that I picked up on is, I have to say, when I got to the part with your ex-husband, when you and your ex-husband, you know, were in the honeymoon phase, I started having worries and noticed tendencies of just things he would do that are like, rang alarm bells in my head. Did you want to read a passage from around then? I think I've suggested one.
Yeah, and You had mentioned that there were a few lines that really spoke to you and that parallels you had felt with your own story. So I thought reading that particular passage would be perfect.
I hope I've discovered the right page.
Yes, you have. Thank you. I'm Yours is in four acts. The first act is about my childhood and teenage years in Bangladesh, Hawaii, and Thailand. And then the second act is set in New York, and it is about the relationship and marriage that I was in during my mid-20s. And here's a chapter from that act. Change. Suddenly, here is winter, vast, waiting, a great cat lying patiently for her kill. He quickly figures out to heat a small corner of the barn with space heaters. We bring down the bed and finally sleep on it. We bring home as well his dear dog. Some of our walls are missing still, as are many windows upstairs, but we have a blessed roof. A blessing even greater is you, my love, loyal through the seasons, though there are hardly any windows to sit by without falling through. Without the loan and its monthly installments, my husband and I barely scrape by on what we earn between the restaurant and babysitting. As there isn't anything left to pay for materials or labor for the barn, he has halted all progress. Unable to be purposeful, he spins. He grows more and more insecure. We have an enormous number of bills, possessions, and properties. While I've always lived an ascetic life, he enjoys collecting and buying. We have the mortgages for the barn and his city apartment. He has the bus and the new Prius. We have two sets of car insurance, homeowner's insurance, two storage units in Connecticut and one in the city. Two cars, two properties, and we live like church mice. Ashram mice. Ashram mice who live on steamed veggies cooked on a hot plate. We live week to week, dollar to dollar. While I try to persuade him to relinquish some things, our frugality and uncertainty don't weigh on me or make me feel as though we haven't enough. I feel I always have enough. And I love the feeling of building something together. He and I are working towards stability, comfort, success. While I thrive on adversity, it daunts and depresses him. I sometimes succeed in pulling him from his melancholia and frustration, only to return home and find him back in bed, perusing porn, YouTube, Netflix. I look at him, born with every privilege under the sun, including being treated as the sun. Perhaps this is why here he lies.
Just get famous and rich already, he groans.
I will, I promise. I'm a million-dollar idea that works. I keep my voice small and soft like a molten M&M, lest he declare me vain and grows angry. Without meaning to, he teaches me. We humans become the expectations we assign ourselves. We grow to the limits or limitlessness wherein we place our identity. His temper has grown worse, or I'm not as effective as I was at calming him. He has grown accustomed to me. I watch this storm in the form of a man. I sense him on the lookout, daring life and me to prove his disdain for us correct.
Why are you quiet?
Nothing, sweetheart. Just a bit cold, that's all. What would you like for dinner?
You're always complaining,
he yells. It's not an affront to you. You asked, and I'm sorry. Please, tell me. How does it come undone so easily? Like pulling one end of a string and watching, disbelievingly, the entire spool unravel in a messy heap in my lap. A cat's cradle without an exit or solution. He manages to weaponize every event and twist every word into incentive to feel angry, hurt, disappointed, threatened, insulted. Where did you go? Where do you go?
Where have you gone? Come back. I want to bring him back. I want to smooth away his anger like an iron soothes cloth. At night, his back to me, I want to turn and return him to face me. Look at me, please, again. His trichotillomania has grown worse. Little knots of hair scatter our bedsheets like lost punctuation. I see a moment to nudge my way in. I lull him, bring him back. I make him laugh. I remind him he is loved. He croons his favorite song, I Won't Grow Up, from Peter Pan. He smiles again. In place of work, he devotes most of his day to Netflix. He rifles through actresses, pointing out parts of their bodies more attractive than mine. You're too bony. Those are breasts. He concocts stories of having sex with various actresses. The alleged rendezvous took place years ago in Europe when touring with his band, or out in L.A., or in Manhattan. He claims if he wanted to bed them, he could, again. On his bad days, he tells me I am his wife for greensies, not realsies. On the rare good day, I return to being his wife for realsies. He calls me wife for greensies to remind me that my green card is dependent on him, to remind me that power only responds to power, and as a mere Bangladeshi immigrant woman, to his white male American privilege, I have no power. To remind me that his love can be withdrawn so easily, that I can be disowned and perhaps deported so casually. To remind me I am caught by a noose woven partly by my complicit hands. I am stunned by the nonchalance with which he wounds. America's almighty sun, around him I orbit. Sometimes he adopts a baby voice. I've known girls to do that, to be cute or coy. It's disconcerting. He pouts, dons the voice and puppy dog eyes during apologies following his daily explosions. I'm sorry, baby. I yelled at my boss. I might be fired. He sticks out his bottom lip, raises his eyebrows, his enormous blue eyes beckoning like the sea. He means to endear me. I don't feel endeared. I feel like his mother. I voice nothing. One followed by another, my flaws stack, a looming monolith of traits he finds insufferable. You're too calm, he says. You're too ambitious, he says. Too intelligent, too disciplined, too polite, too thin, too measured, too responsible, too young, too mature, too optimistic, too realistic, too perfect, in a way he no longer finds attractive. Imperfect, in a way he no longer finds charming. It seems my lifelong crime is that I'm obstinately myself. He desires for me to change my molecular design. Seemingly overnight, I can do no right. I morph from perfection incarnate to a cancerous blight.
Thank you. You have been listening to Rima Zaman, reading from her memoir, I Am Yours. Thank you for reading that. That was, that must have been kind of hard to read. It's a hard part of your life.
Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate that. It's actually not very hard.
Okay.
Because it's firmly in the past. And I think that was the remarkable transformation that I was able to go through while writing this book is all my wounds scarred over. So every day now I'm able to speak with confidence and self-assurance because I'm speaking from the scar and not the raw, hot wound. And I talk about that a lot, about making sure to allow our wounds to heal over so we can then stand in strength and inside of our purpose and to speak and write from scar tissue.
So the passage I actually connected with Thankfully, I'm not very connected with the manipulative stuff that you mentioned. I'm not perfect, but we humans become the expectations we assign ourselves. We grow to the limits or limitlessness wherein we place our identity. And I don't completely understand that, but I do have like the same, the one issue I would have with him is that I do not accomplish very much. And I'm not on Netflix every day, but I do play Madden football among other video games, and don't write everything I would like to be writing. But I think, and I also, and I come from a place of relative privilege compared to most people on the planet.
Right. You identify as a cisgender white man?
Who grew up in middle class America. Yeah. I think middle class America might be a little more, I mean, a white man probably helps a lot.
It does.
Even in other countries. I wouldn't know because I've barely been in, other than Canada, I've barely been in any. But I would think that I may not have won the complete lottery, but I got a huge hit on my first birthday.
Yeah, and so that's one of the accidental teachings that my ex-husband would model and show me about without him knowing that, because I would watch him. You know, he was this gorgeous white man born into an enormous privilege, and I would, and it was incredibly talented, incredibly charismatic man. I mean, I fell head over heels in love with him very quickly. And you know, as a woman from a third world country and as an immigrant, and my I had been taught unwavering work ethic from the time I was a little girl, because it had been modeled to me by my parents, and they worked and fought so hard to give my siblings and I a fantastic education, because we immigrants know that education is the ticket to freedom. And it never, it was inconceivable to me to ever skip a day of school or a class or, you know, in high school or in college, and because it would be dishonoring my parents in the most, not in a shameful way, but in a, because I believed in the values that they put in me, and because education is the greatest gift, and so is opportunity, and not all of us are born into opportunity, and because opportunity is a privilege. And so when I, that was one of the biggest culture shocks of when I moved to the States, is seeing a lot of my peers, because they had been born into a different kind of and a far more privileged background, watching a lot of people take that for granted. And it was put into stark relief when I got married to my husband. And he was a very hardworking man when it pleased him. And I watched the parallels happen, which is, you know, we human beings, we need to feel purposeful to feel truly satisfied with who we are. And when we allow that purpose to slip away, our shadows start to bubble up.
That sounds really important. That's probably closer to my issues than...
Yeah.
But I would also think that one of the things that may help help readers from your book is that, I mean, he isolated you.
Yes.
He, I mean, there are a number of things that just, like, the alarm bell started going off in my head.
Yeah, it was a lot of, so... Bullies and abusers are governed by insecurity. And because of that deep insecurity, it will manifest as enormous control issues. And there are some pivotal red flags when it comes to abusive partners and abusive relationships, one of them being isolation. Another one is gaslighting. Another one is also, you know, any kind of control over the finances in a partnership, control over, he tried to control what I wore, how I, even makeup, he would wipe away wipe makeup off my face, anything to assert control and dominance, that's a sign of an abusive partner. And anything to, you know, to create fear in a person's life, because it's all about creating dependency and very toxic codependency and toxic submission and dominance, so that the abused partner stays inside that cage for longer and longer periods of time. When I was on the Dear Sugars podcast with Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond, and we were talking about, you know, identifying these key things, and one of the things I said, and I talk about this often, is that an abusive relationship is like a solitary chamber, like a solitary imprisonment, and you enter this chamber with, as a specific person. You may have a specific level of confidence and self-esteem, self-assurance and intelligence and wherewithal in the world. But then this solitary chamber begins to fill with toxic, poisonous gas in the form of gaslighting, in the form of unkindness, in the form of daily verbal harassment and abuse and psychological harassment and abuse, so that this poisonous gas starts to deplete the levels of confidence and self-esteem that you initially had. And that's why so many of us who have been in toxic relationships will say to ourselves, how am I still here? Why am I so stupid? How can I not get myself out of this? And it's because it's not our shame to carry, and it's not stupidity on our parts at all.
No.
It's because the longer you're inside that gas chamber, those levels of intelligence and wherewithal begin to deplete because of the abuser's behavior, because of the toxic diatribe that we're subjected to, in the guise of love. And so it's very hard to kind of catch yourself. And the way I started catching all of this and catching his attempted manipulation, catching my second guessing, catching his gaslighting, was because I started to write. And I started waking up with these essays. And I would write them down. And even if I, during my day when I was with him, I was still so much in his toxic grip, I would return to the page, and there were the words sent to me by a higher and wiser self. And I started listening to her truth and adopting it as my own.
Your childhood invisible friend helped you out.
Yeah. Always do. They always do.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
We could talk a lot about identity and the whole, all the other weird, or not, unfortunately not weird, anti-immigrant things in that whole section too, which unfortunately are very
and it wasn't even none of it
prevalent in this country right now.
They are, absolutely. And what I really wanted to, one of the things I'm proud of a lot about the way I wrote about this marriage is that I loved him so much, and there was, everything was very covert. And it was all of these microaggressions, which are so hard to identify at the time that they're happening. And then, you know, and so I wanted to write about that subtlety that so many of us, because of the subtle nature of it, it actually happens in so many people's lives more than we guess or suspect. And I wanted to figure out a way to write about all of this that was clear yet subtle at the same time, because that's how the nature of it actually is.
So you have been listening to Rima Zaman read from her new memoir that just came out last week, or came out, or is coming out in a month, depending on when you're listening to this show, on KBO Portland, 9.7 in your FM dial. And one of the things that was surprising to me was that, Ms. Simon, you are working and living in Beaverton right now.
Yes, actually. I am.
And and you actually, you consider Beaverton lovely enough.
I do.
And me being a someone who grew up in suburban New York, Long Island, and tried to go as far away as possible, even though he loves Manhattan for what it is. I've worked in Beaverton for a long period of time, and since I no longer do, I can start, ragging on Beaverton again, well, which I don't really want to do.
I do have this, and you had mentioned this, that there's this line that Beaverton feels like aloe against a blistered heart, and it does, because that is my truth. I was born in Bangladesh, then raised in Thailand, and then I moved to New York when I was 18, and I was in upstate New York at Skidmore College for the first 4 years when I was here in the States for college, and then I moved into Manhattan to be a model and an actress, and all of the cities I had lived in until I moved to Beaverton, in every single area, I felt incredibly sexualized and objectified due to the nuances of each particular culture. And, I mentioned that my life had been visited by sexual predators from the time I was 11 years old. You know, a cousin 20 years my senior in Bangladesh had tried to molest me when I was 11, and when I reported him, I was told boys will be boys, and that this happens, especially between cousins. And in that moment, I realized a few things. I realized that sexual predators exist and continue to exist because there is a globe-spanning culture of silencing children and enabling predators. And the other thing was that happened was I made a vow to become a voice for the voiceless. And then, you know, in New York, when I was there, as you know, because of the industries I was in, it only amplified the kind of carnivorous air that one does find in Manhattan. And again, everywhere you look is a big billboard with a half-naked woman, her body being used to sell products that we pretty much don't necessarily need. And I was going every day to audition to be those girls on those billboards, and or those girls selling the fancy shiny car, or to play the role of yet another ditzy girlfriend on a sitcom.
I'm so curious what sitcom that was.
Oh, there were a lot. I mean, I would have like 7 auditions a day. And I started to feel the compounding effect that the more I was around all of this messaging, the smaller I held myself in my personal relationships with men. I started behaving as that ditzy girlfriend in my own relationships. And I would have this split experience of watching myself in horror behave a certain way, behave the way I did not want to behave, pandering to abusive men, or at least to very misogynistic men. And it was because of all of those factors that I realized I just needed to get myself out of that mindset, that world, that occupation, because it had taken residence in my soul to a very debilitating, harmful effect. And so when I came to Beaverton, and it's probably because I was living not as an actress, not as a wife, not as a lover, not as a partner, I was living as a daughter. So it was this very innocent life that I stepped back into. And it was beautiful to feel for the first time in my life not to be groped, to not hear catcalls when I walked down the street, to feel safe in my own body, because I hadn't felt that since I was 11 years old. And it showed me the deeper, you know, just gave me deeper understanding of the pervasiveness of all of that toxic misogyny and patriarchy that swills around us. And when we women say, like, you know, it is a daily barrage, and it is a daily battle to keep our calm, to keep our self-esteem intact, to keep our power intact in a world that does its all to make us feel small and powerless.
Now that you said all that, I completely understand. It actually makes sense.
So now you understand what I mean.
I completely understand. I just have an issue with car culture. And,
right.
But
just suburbia. How I explained it, and it goes back to our initial, the point we were making. There's a lot that, because of the way you were born, there are certain things that your body and your heart are, it doesn't need to pick up on, pick up on. Like for me, security and sanctity in my body is something I'm constantly aware of because of the experiences and because of my cultural background.
Yeah. And whereas I'm a guy, so yeah, I'm a white guy especially, so that's, I don't have any fear walking around downtown Portland, whereas my wife tells me about getting catcalled downtown Portland.
Yep. Yeah.
But at the same time, I grew up in suburbia, so I equate suburbia with racism and a lot of other unpleasant things.
Right.
That I like to avoid.
Right, of course. Don't we all?
Yeah, whereas the Beaverton is probably not as prevalent as it was in 1980s Long Island.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and racism takes on, there's racism everywhere, and it just lives in different forms.
Beaverton also is a little, probably, Long Island is very segregated, actually, and people don't realize that. And suburban New York,
right.
and Beaverton is not as segregated. It's obviously Oregon is not very multi-ethnic, unfortunately.
No, it
but
isn't.
For because of its history, but at the same time, Beaverton is not is a little bit more multi-ethnic probably than the rest of Portland in some ways.
Yeah, I am proudly bringing the brown.
There are other people too, it's not completely like that. But yeah.
Yeah.
So we got about 10 more minutes. Did you want to read anything else, or did you want to talk about your any other upcoming projects or readings you have?
I'm going on book tour starting February 5th, and there's a slew of events that are announced every day. I'm very active on Instagram and Facebook, and my team and I have an amazing team of publishers and agents and publicists, and so there's always new events.
And people can find those at
Rima Zaman. I'm Rima Zaman on every single social media handle, as well as RimaZaman.com. I'm very easy to find.
And you're the only one right now.
That I know of.
Okay.
Yes. So this is going to air on February 11th, said? So February
Second
11th.
Monday.
On February 11th, when this airs, I will be on a flight to LA. February 12th, I will have an event at the Last Bookstore in LA at 7:30 p.m. So please come. It is a gorgeous bookstore. February 13th, I'll be in San Francisco at Green Apple Books. February 14th, I'll also be in San Francisco performing at the Battery. And then February 18th, what is it? Okay, where am I? February 15th, I'll be in Utah. February 16th, I'll be flying back to good old Portland. And then February 17th will be Lydia Yuknovich and myself at Powell's. And that's my big Powell's launch. So please come on by. Lydia and I will be, she will be for sure. And I will attempt to be quite charming. And
I'm sure you'll succeed at that.
Lydia is one of my most beloved human beings in the entire planet. And she has been such an amazing mentor and teacher and friend for me. I actually met Lydia 3 years ago at her Powell's reading for The Small Backs of Children. And we met, and it was love. And here we are. And she gave I Am Yours a gorgeous blurb, and one of the things that I'm really, really passionate about is mentorship and passing the torch forward. There have been so many powerful, brilliant women who have taught me from afar for many years. I mean, I had loved and gained so much from Lydia through her writing and her books for years, long before I actually met her in person. And it was, it's really gorgeous that her voice helped mentor and raise mine without her knowing. And then I wrote this book, and then this book allowed me to find her. And that has happened. It's the most seamless love. And that has happened with, you know, with Cheryl Strayed. She, when I read Wild, her memoir in 2013, it was given to me as my 30th birthday present by my sister-in-law, Meryl. We always exchange books, her and I. And she gave me this book and she said, "You have to read it. It will change your life." And sure enough, you know, it did change my life as well as millions of other lives. and when I read Wild, I fell in love with it for many reasons, but one of the biggest gifts it held for me was Cheryl has this amazing ability to show her full vulnerable self without any apology or take backs or any excuses, and she stands in her strength at the same time of standing in her vulnerable truth. And I'd never seen that before executed in the way that she so deftly does, and it allowed me to gain so much permission that I could, because I had thought that, you know, as an imperfect human being, why would anybody want to read about my life? And Cheryl modeled for me that, first of all, we don't have to apologize for our alleged imperfections, and perhaps our imperfections aren't even imperfect. They are merely the fault lines we have traveled in life that have actually given us the wisdom we need to now share with others. And Cheryl, for me, embodies permission to be my full self, permission to voice my full roar. And it was 8 days after I read Wild, I sat down to write my own memoir. And Cheryl gave me the honor of blurbing I Am Yours. And again, but it was a very seamless love. I could have very well become a stalker, but I didn't. I just loved her from afar for a long time. And then she, you know, her team put out a submission call, an open submission call for anyone who has had a story having to do with emotional violence or intimate partner violence and emotional abuse. And she put out this call on Twitter, and I sent an email to their team email saying, I'm not going through an experience like that now, but I did in the past, and I wrote a book about it. So if you need someone to share their takeaways, I'm more than happy to be of service. And then she called me on, and when I met her, I think I just like giggled for a long time, and I think I like looked very intently at her, which she probably gets a lot. And I just kept, and she kept on saying, "Oh, thank you, you're amazing, thank you for being here." And I just kept on staring deep in her eyes, probably very awkwardly, and saying, "Thank you. It's because of you I am here." And she was like, "Okay, that's great." But no, she continues to inspire me every day. And yeah, it's true. I am here and I'm who I am because of the words and the women who came before me.
Thank you for saying all that, Rima. We still have about 5 more minutes.
Okay. I mean, I can ramble for ages. Well,
I could ask you about, you said you were writing a dystopian novel.
I am. So that's.
I don't want to jinx it, though.
No, totally fine. Because we're not jinxing it. We're speaking it into being, which I am a very big fan and believer of. I mean, I spoke this entire...
My wife is a very non-fan of that. Well, worries about that all the time.
I am. Okay. So yeah, I'm writing a dystopian novel, and it takes place in the present as well as 15 years forward. And the premise is that a corrupt government has taken over, and has the dark overlord has unleashed a biochemical weapon that affects only women and girls' bodies. And it makes us turn on ourselves through cutting, starving, burning, if we choose not to follow the orders of the corrupt government. So, lo and behold, every woman is pretty much reduced to becoming a terrified robot. and has to follow the orders of this dark overlord. However, unbeknownst to anyone, because it was not, could not have been planned for, there is a group of girls and women who have been, unbeknownst to them until now, they were born with a genetic mutation that gives them immunity to this biochemical weapon. So they can't let this secret out, because were the government to know, they would imprison them. So they become these, unwilling rebels. And they have this duty, because they're the only ones who can really override the biochemical agent, and they have to band together underground and figure out how to mobilize action and bring about a revolution. So that's what's going on present day. And then 15 years forward, we see the inevitable ramifications, the inevitable negative ramifications on an entire generation of children who have been raised by mothers who are incapable of being truly present for them. We also see the inevitable negative ramifications on a generation of men who have had female partners who are not truly there either. And 15 years forward, we also see what has happened with this band of rebels, and if they've actually been able to mobilize and set forward this revolution that the world at that point so desperately needs.
Looking forward to reading it.
Thank you. So it's basically my second memoir.
Hopefully not.
You know, I feel like dystopian novels are just, it's like comedy. In both comedy and in dystopian writing, what you do is basically you take a real premise. You observe the world around you, and you take all these things from reality, and then you just start upping the ante. You raise the stakes to see if we continue down this path, what could happen? And you tease out the truth that could actually happen if we were to go on ignorant of it.
I'm kind of curious how the society deals with men in the current timeline as opposed to later. Obviously, it deals with them later on. But.
Yeah. Well, it's not dealing with as much as, like, I mean, the one of the biggest messages is that when you subjugate women, everyone suffers.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And of course, there's so many men who are allies and who would never wish that upon their partners, their mothers, their sisters, their daughters. And so, that's all part of the book.
Looking forward to reading it.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Rima Zaman. You've been listening to Talking Earth. She is going to be reading, your next reading in Portland is February 17th.
In Portland. Yes. So when this is airing. Yes. Because it's February 11th is the air date of this episode. So yes, my next will be Powell's, February 17th. Come on by.
See you there.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank Rima Zaman for coming on again, and I remind everyone that she does have that show, that reading with Lydia Yugovich at Powell's, coming up later this week. And I'm having slight sound problems. I'm sorry about that. So please stay tuned for Subhuman Intellect Theater. This has been Talking Earth. Barbara Lamorticella is returning next week. Barbara Lamorticella is returning next week.
いけませんわそんな。河野先生。言わせてもらいます。この度は私の意見に従ってください。もしものことがあれば国連が責任を持つ。もしものことがあってから責任を持ったって何になるんです。人類は滅亡するかもしれないんですよ。いっそのことゴラスが地球で見つかって。 みんな死んじまった方が幸せかもしれないんだ。
太陽系に侵入すれば45日目に地球に到達します。
制作費3億8000万、東方が世界に誇る宇宙科学人と特殊撮影を駆使して雄大なスケールで描く超スペクタクル巨編妖精グラス、妖精グラス、ここに堂々完成。
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the second annual Dance and Resist, Thursday, February 14th at 10 p.m. at Open Signal, Portland Community Media Center. Dance and Resist is Portland's only activist-led live television dance party. For Crying Out Meow Productions is proud to welcome back host and activist Cat Meow Garcia, joined this time by musician DJ Vicky for a night of resistance. Dance and Resist practices reclaiming community space through dance and revolutionary education. There will be a green screen photo booth, and costumes are highly encouraged. Again, that's Dance and Resist, too. Thursday, February 14th at 10 p.m. till midnight at Open Signal, 2766 Northeast MLK Jr. Boulevard, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. Most films will show at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building,